Chapter 25. After Pat had photo-recorded the inscriptions and the strange global maps inside the burial chamber, she and Giordino were airlifted to Cape Town, where they met with Rudy Gunn in the hospital soon after his operation. Causing a scene bordering on an uproar, Gunn ignored the orders of the hospital staff and enlisted Giordino to smuggle him on an airplane out of South Africa. Giordino gladly complied, and with Pat's able assistance, sneaked the tough little Pneuma director past the doctors and nurses through the utility basement of the hospital and into a limousine, before speeding to the city airport, where a Pneuma executive jet was waiting to fly them all back to Washington. Pitt remained behind with Dr. Hatfield and the Navy SEAL team. Together, they carefully packed the artifacts and directed their airlift by helicopter to a Pneuma deep ocean research ship that had been detoured to St. Paul Island. Hatfield hovered over the mummies, delicately wrapping them in blankets from the ship and carefully arranging them in wooden crates for the journey to his lab at Stanford University for in-depth study. After the last mummy had been loaded onto the Pneuma helicopter, Hatfield accompanied them and the artifacts on the short flight to the ship. Pitt turned and shook hands with Lieutenant Jacobs. "Thank you for your help, Lieutenant, and please thank your men for me. We'd have never done it without you." "We don't often get an assignment chaperoning old mummies," Jacobs said, smiling. "I'm almost sorry the terrorists didn't try and snatch them from us." "I don't think they were terrorists in the strict sense of the word. A murderer is a murderer by any other name." "Are you headed back to the States?" Jacobs nodded. "We've been ordered to escort the bodies of the attackers, so ably dispatched by your friends, to Walter Reed Hospital in D.C. for examination and possible identification." "Good luck to you," said Pitt. Jacobs threw a brief salute. "Maybe we'll meet again somewhere." "If there is a next time, I hope it's on a beach in Tahiti." Pitt stood in the never-ending drizzle and watched as a Marine Osprey tilt-rotor aircraft hung in the air above the ground, and the Marines climbed on board. He was still standing there when the plane disappeared into a low cloud. He was now the only man on the island. He walked back into the now empty burial chamber and took one final look at the global charts etched into the far wall. The floods had been removed, and he beamed a flashlight on the ancient nautical charts. Who were the ancient cartographers who'd drawn such incredibly accurate maps of the Earth so many millenniums ago? How could they have charted Antarctica when it was not buried under a massive blanket of ice? Could the southern polar continent have possessed a warmer climate several thousand years ago? Could it have been habitable for humans? The picture of an ice-free Antarctica wasn't the only incongruity. Pitt had not mentioned it to the others, but he was disturbed by the position of the other continents and Australia. They were not where they were supposed to be. It appeared to him that the Americas, Europe, and Asia were shown almost 2,000 miles farther north than they should be. Why had the ancients, who otherwise calculated the shorelines with such exactness, have placed the continents so far off their established locations in relation to the circumference of the Earth? The observation puzzled him. The seafarers clearly had a scientific ability that went far beyond the cultural races and civilizations who followed them. Their era also appeared more advanced in the art of writing and communication than others that came thousands of years later. What message were they trying to pass on across the constantly moving sea of time that was imperishably engraved in stone? A message of hope, or a warning of natural disasters to come? The thoughts running through Pitt's mind were interrupted as the sounds of rotor blades and engine exhaust echoed through the tunnel, announcing the return of the helicopter that was to carry him to the research ship. With a sense of reluctance, he turned off his mind at the same instant he switched off the flashlight and walked from the dark chamber. Without wasting time waiting for government transportation, Pitt flew from Cape Town to Johannesburg, where he caught a South African Airlines flight to Washington. He slept most of the way, taking a short walk to stretch his legs when the plane landed in the Canary Islands to refuel. When he stepped out of the Dulles Airport terminal, it was nearly midnight. He was pleasantly surprised to find a dazzling 1936 Ford Cabriolet hot rod with the top down, waiting at the curb. The car looked like something out of California in the 1950s. The body and fenders were painted in metallic plum maroon that sparkled under the lights of the terminal. The bumpers were the ribbed type from a 1936 DeSoto. Ripple moon discs covered the wheel in front, while those in the rear were hidden by teardrop skirts. The seats in front, and in the rumble seat, were a biscuit tan leather. The elegant little car was powered by a V8 flathead engine that had been rebuilt from top to bottom to produce 225 horsepower. The rear end was fitted with a 50-year-old Columbia overdrive gear system. If the car wasn't enough to turn heads, the woman sitting behind the wheel was equally beautiful. The long cinnamon hair was protected from the light breeze outside the airport by a colorful scarf. She had the prominent cheekbones of a fashion model, enhanced by full lips and a short, straight nose and charismatic violet eyes. She was wearing an alpaca chunky autumn leaf brown turtleneck with taupe wool tweed pants under a taupe shearling coat that came down to her knees. Congresswoman Lauren Smith of Colorado flashed an engaging smile. "How many times have I met you like this and said, 'Welcome home, sailor'?" "At least 8 that I can think of," said Pitt, happy that his romantic love of many years had taken the time out of her busy schedule to pick him up at the airport in one of the cars from his collection. He threw his duffel bag in the rumble seat, then slid into the passenger's seat and leaned over and kissed her, holding her in his arms for a long while. When he finally pulled back and released her, she gasped, catching her breath. "Careful! I don't want to end up like Clinton." "The public applauds affairs by female politicians." "That's what you think," Lauren said, pressing the ignition lever on the steering column and pushing the starter button. It fired on the first rotation and emitted a mellow, throaty roar through the Smitty mufflers and dual exhaust pipes. "Where to, your hangar?" "No, I'd like to drop by NUMA headquarters for a moment and check my computer for the latest word from Hiram Yeager on a program we're working on." "You must be the only single man in the country who doesn't have a computer in his apartment." "I don't want one around the house," he said seriously. "I have too many other projects going without wasting time surfing the internet and answering email." Lauren pulled away from the curb and steered the Ford onto the broad highway leading into the city. Pitt sat silent and was still lost in thought when the George Washington Monument came into view, illuminated by the lights at its base. Lauren knew him well enough to flow with the current. It was only a question of a few minutes before he came back down to earth. "What's new in Congress?" he asked finally. "As if you cared," she replied indifferently. "Boring as that?" "Budget debates don't exactly make a girl horny." Then her voice took on a softer tone. "I heard that Rudy Gunn was shot up pretty badly." "The surgeon in South Africa, who specializes in bone reconstruction, did an excellent job. Rudy will be limping for a few months, but that won't stop him from directing NUMA operations from behind his desk." "Al said you had a rough time in the Antarctic."
"Not as rough as they had it on a rock that makes Alcatraz Island look like a botanical garden."
He turned to her with a reflective look in his eyes and said, "You're on the International Trade Relations Committee?"
"I am."
"Are you familiar with any large corporations in Argentina?"
"I've traveled there on a few occasions and met with their finance and trade ministers," she answered. "Why do you ask?"
Ever hear of an outfit calling itself the New Destiny Company or Fourth Empire Corporation?
Lauren thought a moment. I once met the CEO of Destiny Enterprises during a trade mission in Buenos Aires. If I remember correctly, his name was Carl Wolf.
How long ago was that? Pitt asked.
About 4 years.
You've got a good memory for names.
Carl Wolf was a handsome and stylish man. A real charmer. Women don't forget men like that.
If that's the case, why do you still hang around me?
She glanced over and gave him a provocative smile.
Women are also drawn to earthy, coarse, and carnal men.
Coarse and carnal, that's me.
Pitt put his arm around her and bit her earlobe. She tilted her head away.
Not when I'm driving.
He gave her right knee an affectionate squeeze and relaxed in the seat, looking up at the stars that twinkled in the brisk spring night through the branches of the trees that flashed overhead, their new leaves just beginning to spread.
Carl Wolf.
He turned the name over in his head.
A good German name, he decided. Destiny Enterprises was worth looking into, even if it might prove to be a dead end.
Lauren drove smoothly, deftly passing the few cars that were still on the road that time of morning, and turned into the driveway leading to the NUMA headquarters building's underground parking. A security guard stepped out of the guardhouse, recognized Pitt, and waved him through, lingering to admire the gleaming old Ford. There were only three other cars on the main parking level. She stopped the Ford next to the elevators and turned off the lights and engine.
"Want me to come up with you?" Lauren asked.
"I'll only be a few minutes," Pitt said, stepping from the car.
He took the elevator to the main lobby, where it automatically stopped, and he had to sign in with the guard at the security desk, surrounded by an array of TV monitors viewing different areas of the building.
"Working late?" the guard asked pleasantly.
"Just a quick stop," Pitt remarked, fighting off a yawn. Before taking the elevator up to his office, Pitt stepped off on the 10th floor on a hunch. True to his intuition, Hiram Yeager was still burning the midnight oil. He looked up as Pitt entered his private domain, eyes red from lack of sleep. Max was staring out of her cyberland.
"Dirk," he muttered, rising from his chair and shaking hands. "I didn't expect you to come wandering in this time of night.
Thought I'd see what you and Dr. O'Connell had raked from the dirt of antiquity," he said genially.
"I hate banal metaphors," said Max.
"That's enough from you," Yeager said in mock irritation.
Then he said to Pitt, "I left a printed report of our latest findings on Admiral Sandecker's desk as of 10 o'clock this evening. I'll borrow and return it first thing in the morning."
"Don't rush. He's meeting with the director of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Agency until noon."
"You should be home with your wife and daughters," said Pitt.
"I was working late with Dr. O'Connell," said Yeager, rubbing his tired eyes.
"You just missed her."
"She came in and went to work without resting up after her trip?" Pitt asked in surprise.
"A truly remarkable woman. If I wasn't married, I'd throw my hat in her ring."
"You always had a thing for academic women."
"Brains over beauty, I always say."
"Anything you can tell me before I wade through your report?" Pitt queried.
"An amazing story," said Yeager, almost wistfully.
"I'll second that," Max added.
"This is a private conversation," Yeager said testily to Max's image, before he closed her down. He stood up and stretched.
"What we have is an incredible story of a seafaring race of people who lived before the dawn of recorded history, and who were decimated after a comet struck the earth, causing great waves that engulfed the city ports that they had built in almost every corner of the globe. They lived and died in a forgotten age and a far different world than we know today."
When I last talked to the Admiral, he didn't rule out the legend of Atlantis.
The lost continent in the middle of the Atlantic doesn't fit into the picture, Jaeger said seriously. But there is no doubt that a league of maritime nations existed whose people had extensively sailed every sea and charted every continent.
He paused and looked at Pitt.
The photos Pat took of the inscriptions inside the burial chamber and the map of the world are in the lab. They should be ready for me to scan into the computer first thing in the morning.
They show placements of the continents far different than an Earth of the present, Pitt said contemplatively.
Jaeger's bloodshot eyes stared thoughtfully.
I'm beginning to sense that something more catastrophic than a comet strike took place. I've scanned the geological data my people have accumulated over the past 10 years. The Ice Age ended quite abruptly in conjunction with a wild fluctuation of the sea. The sea level is over 300 feet higher than it was 9,000 years ago.
That would put any building or relics of the Atlanteans quite deep under the coastal waters.
Not to mention deeply buried in silt.
Did they call themselves Atlanteans? Asked Pitt.
I doubt they knew what the word meant, replied Jaeger. Atlantis is Greek and means daughter of Atlas. Because of Plato, it's become known through the ages as the world before history began, or what is called an antediluvian civilization. Today, anyone who can read, and most who don't, have a knowledge of Atlantis. Everything from resort hotels, technology and finance companies, retail stores, swimming pool manufacturers, and 1,000 products, including wines and food brands, carry the name Atlantis. Countless articles and books have been written about the lost continent, as well as its being a subject of television and motion pictures. But until now, only those who believed in Santa Claus, UFOs, and the supernatural thought it was more than simply a fictional story created by Plato.
Pitt walked to the doorway and turned back.
I wonder what people will say, he said wistfully, when they find out such a civilization actually existed.
Jaeger smiled.
Many of them will say, I told you so.
When Pitt left Jaeger and exited the elevator to the executive offices of NUMA, he couldn't help noticing the lights in the hallway leading to Admiral Sandecker's suite were dimmed to their lowest level. It seemed strange they were still switched on, but he figured there could be any number of reasons for the faint illumination. At the end of the hallway, he pushed the glass door open into the anteroom outside the Admiral's inner office and private conference room. As he stepped inside and walked past the desk occupied by Julie Wolfe, the Admiral's secretary, he smelled the distinctive fragrance of orange blossoms. He paused in the doorway and groped for the light switch. In that instant, a figure leaped from the shadows and ran at Pitt, bent over at the waist. Too late, he stiffened as the intruder's head rammed square into his stomach. He stumbled backward, staying on his feet but doubling over, the breath knocked out of him. He made a grab at his assailant as they spun, but Pitt was caught by surprise, and his arm was easily knocked away. Gasping for breath, with one arm clutching his midsection, Pitt found the light and switched it on. One quick glance at Sandecker's desk, and he knew the intruder's mission. The Admiral was fanatical about keeping a clean desk. Papers and files were put carefully in a drawer each evening before he left for his Watergate apartment. The surface was empty of Jaeger's report on the ancient seafarers. His stomach feeling as if it had been tied in a huge knot, Pitt ran to the elevators. The one with the thief was going down. The other elevator was stopped on a floor below. He frantically pushed the button and waited, taking deep breaths to get back on track. The elevator doors spread and he jumped in, pressing the button for the parking lot. The elevator descended quickly without stopping. Thank God for Otis elevators, Pitt thought. He was through the doors before they opened fully and ran to the hot rod just as a pair of red taillights vanished up the exit ramp. He threw open the driver's door, pushed Lauren to one side, and started the engine.
Lauren looked at him questioningly.
"What's the emergency?"
"Did you see the man who just took off?" he asked, as he depressed the clutch, shifted gears, and stomped the accelerator pedal.
"Not a man, but a woman wearing an expensive fur coat over a leather pantsuit."
Lauren would notice such things, Pitt thought. As the Ford's engine roared and the tires left twin streaks of rubber on the floor of the parking garage amid a horrendous squealing noise. Shooting up the ramp, he hit the brakes and skidded to a stop at the guardhouse. The guard was standing beside the driveway, staring off into the distance.
"Which way did they go?" Pitt shouted.
"Shot past me before I could stop them," the security guard said dazedly. "Turned south onto the parkway. Should I call the police?"
"Do that," Pitt snapped, as he slung the car out onto the street and headed for the Washington Memorial Parkway only a block away.
"What kind of car?" he tersely asked Lauren.
"A black Chrysler 300M series with a 3.5-liter 253-horsepower engine, 0 to 50 miles an hour in 8 seconds.
"You know its specifications?" he asked dumbly.
"I should," Lauren answered briefly. "I own one, have you forgotten?"
It slipped my mind in the confusion.
"What's the horsepower of this contraption?" she shouted above the roar of the flathead engine.
"About 225," Pitt replied, back shifting and throwing the hot rod into a four-wheel drift upon entering the parkway.
"You're outclassed."
"Not when you consider we weigh almost 1,000 pounds less," Pitt said calmly, as he pushed the Ford through the gears. "Our thief may have a higher top-end speed and handle tighter in the turns, but I can out-accelerate her." The modified flathead howled as the RPMs increased. The needle of the speedometer on the dashboard behind the steering wheel was approaching 95 when Pitt flicked the switch to the Columbia rear end and pushed the car into overdrive. The engine revolutions immediately dropped off as the car accelerated past the 100-mile-per-hour mark. Traffic was light at 1 o'clock in the morning on a weekday, and Pitt soon spotted the black Chrysler 300M under the bright overhead lights of the parkway and began to overhaul it. The driver was traveling 20 miles an hour over the speed limit, but not pushing the sleek car anywhere near its potential speed. The driver moved into the empty right-hand lane, seemingly more intent on avoiding the police than worried about the possibility of a car pursuing her from the Numa building. When the Ford was within 300 yards of the newer car, Pitt began to slow down, tucking in behind slower-moving cars, attempting to remain out of sight. He began to feel supremely self-confident, thinking his quarry hadn't noticed him. But then the Chrysler swung a hard turn onto the Francis Scott Key Bridge. Reaching the other side of the Potomac River, it cut a tight left turn and then a right into the residential section of Georgetown, fishtailing around the corner, the tires screeching in protest.
"I think she's on to you," said Lauren, shivering from the cold wind sweeping around the windshield.
"She's smart," Pitt muttered in frustration at losing the game. He gripped the old banjo-style steering wheel and swung it to its stop, throwing the Ford into a 90-degree turn. "Instead of speeding away in a straight line, she's taking every corner in hopes of gaining enough distance until she can turn without us seeing which direction she took." It was a cat-and-mouse game, the Chrysler pulling ahead out of the turns, the 65-year-old hot rod regaining the lost yardage through its greater acceleration. 7 blocks, and still the cars were an equal distance apart, neither one gaining or closing the gap.
"This is a new twist," muttered Pitt, grimly clutching the wheel.
"What do you mean?" He glanced at her, grinning. "For the first time I can remember, I'm the one who's doing the pursuing."
"This could go on all night," said Lauren, clutching the door handle as if ready to eject in case of an accident.
"Or until one of us runs out of gas," Pitt shot back in the middle of a hard turn.
"Haven't we already circled this block once?"
"We have."
Whipping around the next corner, Pitt could see the brake lights of the Chrysler suddenly flash on as it came to an abrupt halt in front of a brick townhouse, one of several on the tree-lined block.
He braked and skidded to a stop in the street alongside the Chrysler, just as the driver vanished through the front door.
"Good thing she gave up the chase when she did," Lauren said, pointing to the steam that was rising above the hood around the radiator.
"She wouldn't have quit unless it's a setup," said Pitt, staring at the darkened townhouse.
"What now, Sheriff? Do we call off the posse?"
Pitt gave Lauren a crafty look.
"No. You're going up and knock on the door."
She looked back at him, her face aghast under the glow of a nearby streetlight.
"Like hell I will."
"I thought you'd refuse."
He opened the door and stepped from the car. "Here's my Global Star phone. If I'm not back in 10 minutes, call the police and then alert Admiral Sandecker. At the slightest noise or movement in the shadows, get out. And get out quick, understand?"
"Why don't we call the police now and report a burglary?"
"Because I want to be there first."
"Are you armed?"
His lips broke into a wide grin.
"Whoever heard of carrying a weapon in a hot rod?"
He opened the glove box and held up a flashlight.
"This will have to do."
Then he leaned into the car, kissed her, and merged into the darkness surrounding the house.
Pitt didn't use the flashlight. There was enough ambient light from the city and the streetlights for him to see his way along a narrow stone sidewalk to the rear of the house. It seemed hauntingly dark and silent. From what he could see, the yard was well-maintained and groomed. High brick walls covered with vines of ivy separated this house from the ones on either side. They also looked dark, their occupants blissfully sleeping in their beds. Pitt was 99% sure the house had a security system, but as long as there were no bloodthirsty dogs, he ignored any attempt at stealth. He was hoping the thief and her pals would show themselves. Only then would he worry about which way to jump. He came to the back door and was surprised to find it wide open. Belatedly, he realized the thief had dashed into the front of the house and out the rear. He took off running for the garage that backed onto an alley. Abruptly, the night silence was shattered by the loud roar of a motorcycle's exhaust. Pitt tore open the door to the garage and rushed inside. The old-fashioned rear doors had been swung outward on their hinges. A figure in a black fur coat over leather pants and boots had urged the motorcycle engine into life, and was in the act of shifting it into gear and turning the throttle grip when Pitt took a running leap and threw himself on the bike rider's back, circling his arms around the neck and falling off to the side, dragging his opponent with him. Pitt knew immediately that Lauren's observations were confirmed. The body was not heavy enough for a man, nor did it feel hard. They crashed to the concrete floor of the garage, Pitt falling on top. The motorcycle dropped onto its side and raced around in a full circle, rear wheel and tire screaming against the concrete floor before the kill switch cut in and the engine stopped. The momentum carried the motorcycle against the crumpled bodies on the floor, the front tire striking the head of the rider as the handlebars impacted with Pitt's hip, breaking no bones but giving him a huge bruise that would show for weeks. He rose painfully to his knees and found the flashlight still beaming in the doorway where he had dropped it. He crawled over, picked it up, and swept the beam over the inert body beside the motorcycle. The rider had not had time to slip on a helmet, and a head with long blonde hair was exposed. He rolled her over onto her back and beamed the light onto her face. A knot was beginning to form above one eyebrow, but there was no mistaking the features. The front tire of the bike had knocked her senseless, but she was alive. Pitt was stunned, so much so that he nearly dropped the flashlight from a hand that had never trembled until now. It is a proven fact in the medical profession that blood cannot run cold, not unless ice water is injected into the veins. But Pitts felt as though his heart was working overtime to pump blood that was 2 degrees below freezing. He swayed on his knees in shock, the atmosphere in the garage suddenly turning heavy with a heavy sense of horror. Pitt was no stranger to the person who lay unconscious beneath him. without the slightest question in his mind. He was looking at the same face he had seen on the dead woman who had tapped his shoulder on the sunken hulk of the U-boat.